Yeah, let's get right into it. So we'll begin by looking at the core essence of the argument. Before addressing how the narrative is actually organized, we really must ensure the fundamental claims can withstand scrutiny from a skeptical audience.
Right. So a key theme running through this material seems to be the absence of critical debate in Israeli society. But looking at the text itself, I mean, does it risk falling into an echo chamber by lacking an adversarial voice? That is exactly the issue. Integrating opposing viewpoints directly into the dialogue will fortify the overarching argument against inevitable skepticism.
Make it a bit more bulletproof.
Exactly. Because right now, the weakness is that the current manuscript features an interviewer who universally agrees with the subject.
Oh, yeah, like when they say, everything you're saying is true and provably true.
Yes, exactly that line. And when you do that, it removes all the essential narrative tension, because the subject's claims are highly controversial.
Very controversial.
Right, like asserting the military's goal is strictly to crash Palestinian society rather than dismantle Hamas. So the lack of pushback actually weakens the robust nature of those claims.
It's like the reader's just sitting there waiting for the other shoe to drop, and it never does.
Precisely. So the suggestion here is to introduce deliberate, constructively framed pushback, or, just devil's advocate questions to test the subject's claims.
By forcing the subject to dismantle those opposing views, the argument becomes what, infinitely stronger?
Infinitely stronger and just way more intellectually satisfying to read.
I hear you on adding devil's advocate questions, but let me push back on that a little bit, right out of the gate.
Sure, go for it.
If the interviewer starts throwing hard counterarguments at a subject who is, pouring their heart out about societal collapse, don't we risk turning a poignant emotional memoir into a sterile Sunday morning political debate?
I mean, that is the exact tightrope the author has to walk. But avoiding the friction altogether is actually far more damaging to the emotional core.
How so?
Well, when a reader approaches a text dealing with a highly charged geopolitical conflict, they naturally arrive with their own deeply ingrained skepticism.
Right, they have preconceived notions.
Exactly. And if the narrative voice, in this case, the interviewer, fails to voice those natural objections, the reader immediately feels alienated.
They start to think, you aren't addressing my very real concerns, so I can't trust your conclusions.
You hit the nail on the head. So by integrating opposing viewpoints directly into the dialogue, you don't create a sterile debate. You actually give the subject a platform to dismantle the strongest possible counterarguments.
Which is thrilling for the reader to witness.
Yes. So it's less about picking a fight and more about stress testing the ideas.
Yes, stress testing. Let me give you a concrete example of how to do this.
Please. When the subject claims the war in Gaza is purely to incite anarchy, the interviewer should inject a question about the genuine existential fear driving the, what was it, the 93% initial public support.
Oh, right. Because to the skeptical reader, that 93% isn't just blind nationalism.
No, not at all. It represents real people reacting to a real, tangible trauma.
So if the interviewer doesn't gently probe that alternative explanation, if they don't say, but wait, isn't that unity born out of sheer existential terror? The subject's conclusion feels hollow.
Exactly. The subject can still maintain their position, of course, but the author must force them to answer that specific question.
Are there any other spots where this friction is desperately needed?
Yeah, another great concrete example is when the subject claims there are no clear goals in Lebanon or Gaza.
Right. My immediate thought there goes to the practical realities on the ground.
Exactly. So introduce the perspective of actual security threats, like the ongoing rocket fire in the north.
And just ask how a nation is supposed to respond to that without military force.
Yes. And then you allow the subject's thoughtful response to serve as the ultimate counterargument. It elevates the subject's intellect, They aren't just preaching to the choir anymore.
That makes total sense. Now that we've discussed how to fortify the individual arguments with dynamic tension, we need to look at how these arguments are assembled.
Structure and flow.
Exactly. Even the strongest points lose their impact if the reader is bouncing erratically through time. As I understand it from the notes, the argument here is that the past strictly dictates the present.
Right.
But structurally, it feels like building a house, starting with the roof, and then bringing in the foundation halfway through. Let's look closely at how we can restructure this.
Yeah, so realigning the historical context to serve as the foundation rather than a midpoint revelation will create a more cohesive and devastating narrative throughline.
Because right now, the weakness is that the text scatters its timeline.
It really does. It starts with present-day Gaza and Lebanon, pivots abruptly to future U.S. elections, jumps backward to the 1948 Nakba.
Then it shifts to the current conflict with Iran.
Yes, and only at the very end does it explain the subject's personal awakening in the 1980s.
It's giving me narrative whiplash just thinking about it.
Exactly. This disjointed pacing dilutes the core thesis that current military actions are an unbroken continuation of historical policies.
So the suggestion is pretty straightforward, right? Group the material chronologically or thematically to build a compounding case.
Yes. Start with the historical and personal roots. Use that foundation to explain the present-day psychology and climax with the geopolitical future.
I can see why the author did it this way originally, though.
Oh, sure.
You can tell they were terrified of losing the geopolitical urgency, which is why they shoved the Iran conflict and U.S. elections right at the top.
It's a very natural instinct. When you're writing about an ongoing war, you want to prove your piece is timely.
Right. You want to hook the reader with the most current headlines. But aren't they just burying the lead here? In standard journalism, you put the urgent news at the top.
Well, that's the thing. This isn't a standard news report. It's a historical and psychological analysis of a society.
Oh, I see.
Present. Then the narrative structure itself must mirror that causality. A causes B, and B causes C.
You can't logically tell the reader about the catastrophic effects of C, yank them back to the origins of A, and then hint at B.
Exactly. You need the mechanism of injury first.
Okay, let's talk concrete examples for this restructuring. The emotional centerpiece of this manuscript is incredibly moving. The story about his parents.
The poignant anecdote about his parents fleeing Europe on an illegal boat in 1939.
Yes, it's a striking, deeply humanizing image. But right now it's just buried at the very end.
So move that story to the absolute beginning. That's the first concrete step. Show us the soil from which these modern conflicts grew.
And then use that personal awakening to frame his historical critique of 1948.
Yes, and from there, transition to how this history manifests in the current Gaza and Lebanon conflicts.
By the time you finally introduce the present-day devastation, it doesn't just read like a news summary. It feels tragically inevitable.
Exactly. And finally, you reserve the geopolitical speculation, such as the warning that the U.S. might withdraw unconditional support, or Netanyahu's lifetime project regarding Iran, for the piece's climax.
Okay, that brings us perfectly to the climax. With the argument fortified and the timeline flowing logically from past to future, we arrive at the ending.
The final takeaway.
Right. The structure now naturally leads us to that geopolitical climax. But we need to ensure the reader is left with something actionable, rather than just a sense of doom. I mean, I can see what you're going for here with the emotional weight at the end.
But is there a risk that focusing solely on the inevitability of the tragedy might let the audience off the hook, making them feel like nothing can be done anyway?
That is the exact risk. Grounding the deeply pessimistic conclusion in specific actionable geopolitical scenarios will elevate the piece from an expression of despair to a vital warning.
Because currently the weakness is that the material ends on a heavily fatalistic note.
Very fatalistic. The subject admits to deep loneliness, expects no change regardless of a shift in leadership, and anticipates, very dark corners for the nation.
Very dark corners. It's incredibly emotionally powerful.
It is, but it leaves the reader asking, so what happens now, without actually exploring the systemic mechanics of the predicted collapse.
So when a writer leaves an audience with pure fatalism, it triggers psychological defense mechanisms.
Exactly. If it's framed as an inevitable slide into a dark abyss, the reader just shuts down. It allows them to sigh, close the document, and move on with their day.
Feeling sad, but entirely unburdened by practical reality.
Precisely. So the suggestion here is to expand on the concrete global consequences that are only briefly mentioned earlier in the text.
Transition the conclusion from pure emotional resignation to a sharp, predictive analysis of what actual diplomatic or economic isolation looks like.
Yes. Let's look at some concrete examples of how to do that.
Okay.
Expand on the brief mention of Europe waiting for a green light from the U.S. Detail exactly how European policy shift would practically manifest.
like economic sanctions or diplomatic severing.
Exactly. Detail those sanctions against the described Israeli societal apathy. The text argues that the majority of the society lives in a state of apathetic denial, shielded by a robust economy.
Right, so that economic shield is the only thing making the denial sustainable.
You hit the nail on the head. So outline the mechanics of that shield shattering.
And another concrete example.
Instead of simply stating that conditioned U.S. aid will be a real problem, explicitly outline what a conditioned aid package would look like.
Explain how it would mechanically force a societal reset.
Yes. Explaining the exact mechanism of the impending isolation is so much more terrifying and actionable than just using poetic phrases.
It forces the reader to confront the tangible reality of the policies being discussed. You make the despair actionable.
Which stops it from being a eulogy and turns it into an essential roadmap of the perilous days ahead.
It demands attention rather than just sympathy.
Exactly.
Well, it all comes down to aligning the structure with the argument. We covered a lot of deep mechanical ground today. To synthesize exactly how the author can implement this, first, introduce deliberate adversarial pushback from the interviewer to dismantle natural reader skepticism and fortify those core claims.
Right.
Second, restructure the timeline so it flows logically from the mechanism of injury, the historical roots, to the present-day trauma, building a compounding historical argument.
And third, ground that haunting, fatalistic ending in concrete geopolitical predictions. Shift the audience from passive melancholy to active engagement.
Exactly. And I want to be incredibly clear. The raw material here is breathtaking. The bravery of the writing is evident on every single page. These structural tweaks will just maximize its impact and ensure the mechanics of the writing can carry the massive weight of these insights.
We highly encourage the listener to apply these actionable suggestions, tear into the manuscript, and submit your revised work back in for a future critique. The foundation of this piece is incredibly strong. Now it's just about applying the pressure to make it unbreakable.